Our first case is Kelly and Weintraub versus Harlow and Populous. Case number 2011 SC889. Both parties ready?
Thank you.
A couple of housekeeping matters. Argument is set for an hour, half hour aside, and the petitioners will have to keep track of your time. And we use, for the benefit of everybody, we use iPads, and most of us use iPads, I should say. And we have our briefs and our notes, the cases on them, so we're not surfing sending our emails. We take our notes as well. And so with that, we'll begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Shannon Stevenson on behalf of petitioner Dr. Jason Kelly. In the trial of this matter, the parties put on evidence of plaintiff's use of cocaine. The defendant's experts relied on that evidence to diagnose all plaintiff's injuries. The district court called this evidence imperative to the defense presentation and the key to this case. Nevertheless, plaintiffs argued that all of this evidence should have been excluded at trial. There's no basis in the rule to support that result. I'd like to begin by addressing the Rule 8034 hearsay exception. I also plan to address our arguments regarding prior inconsistent statement and harmless error. David Yoon, counsel for petitioner Dr. Mauricio Weintraub, will present our arguments on Rules 403 and 703. Let's start with 8034, the hearsay exception for statements made for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment. Plaintiff argues that the district court abused its discretion by admitting one piece of evidence under Rule 8034, and that evidence was Lori Hurd's statement to Dr. Jason Kelly regarding plaintiff's cocaine use. Our view of Rule 8034 is extremely simple. In order to be admissible, a statement must meet the three requirements in the plain language of the rule, nothing more. Ms. Hurd's statement here clearly met those three requirements. First, there's no dispute that it was a statement regarding plaintiff's medical history. Second, it was clearly a statement made for purposes of medical diagnosis. Every definition of diagnosis that's been presented to this court includes an inquiry into the cause of an injury or illness. Ms. Hurd testified that she was seeking an answer or a reason why plaintiff's injuries happened. Therefore, she was clearly looking at the cause of plaintiff's injuries. So her statement was clearly a statement for purposes of medical diagnosis. Third, the statement must be reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis. And there can be no dispute that it was. Not only was it pertinent in this case, here the evidence was actually the cornerstone of a plaintiff's diagnosis. As defendant's experts testified at trial, the evidence explained not only why plaintiff had a cardiac arrest in the first place, but why he was unable to be resuscitated.
It sounds like a litigation diagnosis rather than a treatment diagnosis. Does that make any difference?
It does not, Your Honor. In fact, one of the main purposes when the federal Rule 8034, which is identical to the state rule, was adopted, was to eliminate any distinction between medical diagnosis for litigation purposes and medical diagnosis that takes place in the course of regular treatment. And I think that's entirely consistent with this court's holding in King versus People. And the plaintiff here doesn't argue.
Well, could I just inquire about that? Because isn't the whole point of reliability, the hearsay rules rely on some sort of indicia of reliability, and isn't the whole point for the reliability factor behind this particular hearsay rule the fact that you're not going to lie when you talk to your doctor because you want to get better, and so you're going to tell him or her the truth? You can say, I'm afraid I've been doing X, Y, Z, and that might be causing this. Now, that sort of indicia of reliability, can you explain to me why it's not absent when you're 2-3 weeks after a bad kind of a result and someone else who is not being treated, who may have an interest in this litigation, is making those kinds of statements? Where do we get that intrinsic indicia of reliability that we're looking for?
Sure. I think there's two responses to your question, Justice Rice. The first is, in this situation, clearly Ms. Hurd was motivated to get a correct diagnosis. And the fact that she wasn't sure whether that would impact plaintiff's future treatment, I think, is irrelevant because there's no evidence that she would have wanted any kind of false diagnosis. So, in fact, the rationale behind the rule is fulfilled here. But setting that aside, the rule was adopted because of the reasons, at least in part because of the reasons that you've articulated, But once the statement meets the requirements of the rule, this court has said you do not have to make any independent demonstration of trustworthiness of the statement. Once you meet the requirements,
you're kind of putting the cart before the horse. I mean, it's not, the rules of evidence aren't something where you just sort of check off factors and then the evidence comes in. You have to have an understanding of why information which would be otherwise hearsay is somehow reliable enough to admit.
Right.
And then some factors may help you analyze that indicia of reliability, but it seems to me that you're oversimplifying the trial judge's function here.
Well, I think there are two rationales for the basis for 8034, the selfish treatment motive that you've described. But we know that there are statements that come in under 8034 that don't satisfy that selfish treatment policy. For instance, statements made to testifying experts only for the purposes of litigation diagnosis clearly come in, even though there's no selfish treatment motive there. And that's the holding of this court in King versus People. And the reason why this court was comfortable with that is because of the other aspect of reliability, which is some physician also has to say, and this evidence is reasonably pertinent to diagnosis. So yes, you have the motive of the speaker who is potentially seeking treatment, but sometimes not, for instance, in the case of talking to a testifying expert. But you have the extra layer of reliability, which is a physician saying, and this information is reasonably pertinent to diagnosis or treatment. So in fact, there are two bases.
I'm not sure I understand that. Maybe we can stay on that point just a minute. Going back to Justice Rice's question, I still haven't heard you give an explanation for why the declarant, why an out-of-court statement would be reliable, what the indicia of reliability are from the declarant's point of view in making that statement in the first place, unless it is with regard to ensuring that you get proper treatment.
Well, I think, you know, for instance, in this situation, there was a serious unexplained medical event that had happened.
Can I stop you right there? And you sort of explained that to Justice Rice, but doesn't that go maybe to whether this should come in under another rule, looking for some indicia of reliability? With regard to simply the diagnosis and treatment exception, why in every case should out-of-court statements be considered reliable simply because they apply to a diagnosis, even though it has nothing to do with diagnosis for treatment?
Well, I've got to go back to the plain language of the rule, because this is exactly what it requires. And diagnosis, you know, it says a statement made for purposes of diagnosis or treatment, and that was an important part of the rule.
You seem to be, though, going back to tell me that I'm bound by the rule, whether it's reasonable or not. And I guess what I'm questioning is, it looks like here we are to determine what the rule means. And so don't we need to look at it and say, should we have made the rule that broad? Or did we really mean to make the rule
right.
that broad?
Well, I think the history of the rule clearly indicates that it was intended to be that broad, because again, one of the major purposes was to allow in statements that were made for purposes of litigation medical diagnosis only. And again, the selfish treatment policy is not in play there, and we know that was the purpose of the rule, and that's why diagnosis or treatment were stated in the disjunctive.
And why would that have been the purpose of the rule? What is
right.
there that's inherently reliable about statements that are that broad?
Right. And the court discusses this at length in King and says, because the expert is saying this information is pertinent to medical diagnosis, that makes it reliable. And that was this court's rationale there.
I've seen that kind of evidence come in under 703.
Pardon?
I've seen that kind of evidence come in under 703, which is the rule which allows experts to consider all sorts of things in order to make a 702 opinion. You're familiar with those rules?
Yes.
But I'm not, I don't understand your use of the word diagnosis in this particular instance. I think that's a word of art in the 400 series, which would speak to, the 800 series, which would speak to specifically what the truth would be, what I'm saying to the doctor in order to get better.
Right. Well, I think, again, we've got to talk about the fact that diagnosis and treatment are used in the disjunctive in the statute. And so
I don't think one normally talks, when you're talking about a medical malpractice case, is, you know, I'm going to diagnose what went wrong here. That's not a typical sentence you would hear. You might try to figure it out or deconstruct it, or I'm going to gather lots of information and then try to decide and render an opinion about what went wrong, but you don't really say, I'm going to diagnose what went wrong here. Diagnosis is, to me, a word of art.
Your Honor, we've submitted several different definitions of diagnosis, and they all conclude an inquiry into the cause of an injury or illness. And I think even where that's retrospective, and this gets to the plaintiff's argument of saying the information must have some prospective application, I think that distinction is not present in the rule. And a diagnosis can be backward-looking, and any time you're doing a diagnosis for litigation purposes, there's a good chance it's going to be backward-looking. And so I think to say that diagnosis can only exist where there is a possibility of future treatment is inconsistent with the plain language of the rule, it's inconsistent with this court's cases interpreting rule, and it's inconsistent with one of the major policies of the rule, which was specifically to allow in statements made to testifying experts under 8034 and not under the 700 rules. And there's several good reasons why I think this court shouldn't add these additional criteria on that the plaintiff is urging in this case. For instance, these additional independent demonstrations of trustworthiness or prospective application. It departs from the plain language of the rule, which governs under rules of statutory interpretation. Again, King v. Keeble, I think, is just exceedingly clear on this, that the statement may be made for purposes of diagnosis only, where there's no potential of treatment whatsoever. And finally, I think with Rule 8034, I mean, it's a rule of evidence the district courts are going to be applying on the spot in the heat of trial, and I think they need to be able to look at the plain language of the rule and make that judgment and not be concerned about additional tests that are out in the case law that aren't apparent from the face of the rule. Let me talk also about this issue of fault that the plaintiff has raised and whether the statement should have been excluded because it's somehow related to fault. And I think the plain language of the rule answers this question as well, because if you apply the rule, just the plain language, what you see is if a statement is reasonably pertinent to that medical diagnosis, it should come in. Now, some of those statements may also relate to fault, and if they do, they come in. If the statement isn't reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis, then the statement doesn't come in. So the issue of fault is kind of a red herring. The plain language of the rule really can govern the situation and provide the results that are reflected in all of the cases. And Justice Rice, to come back to your concerns, I mean, the statement that was made in this case, it was a statement about plaintiff's medical history. It was made in an ICU waiting room by the person with whom the plaintiff had spent almost every night for the 6 months leading up to this procedure. It was made shortly after a serious and unexplained medical event in the context of ongoing medical decisions being made. It was made because Ms. Hurd was searching for an answer or a reason why these injuries happened, and it provided key evidence that allowed the experts to diagnose all of plaintiff's injuries, the cause for all of them.
From my reading of the record, though, it seems like there might even be 403 concerns here in the sense that didn't the witness disavow making that statement, disappeared for a while, wasn't around, said no, the doctor misconstrued it, she was talking about a time period, 7 or 8 years earlier, I might be off on those years, I don't exactly recall, but significantly earlier. There's a lot of question about the intrinsic value of the statement, even if it is admissible, and given that it brought in the whole issue of cocaine use, there will certainly be some 403 concerns.
Your Honor, I think not, but I will turn the argument over to Mr. Yoon now, who can address the 403 concerns.
Mr. Yoon, can I just give you a heads up here on the 403 argument?
Yes.
I think we need to understand how you even get to the 403 argument, since it wasn't a question that was sought at appeal. It wasn't a certified question by both parties. and cert wasn't granted. You didn't ask to grant whether, as I understand the Court of Appeals opinion, it was clear that assuming that you're correct substantively on the hearsay issue, that there's an independent basis, which was 403, right?
We did raise the 8034.
Yes, but you didn't raise the 403 as a separate issue.
We did raise it in our petition for certiorari, the 403 argument, Your Honor.
I'm not aware of that.
And the issue as framed by this court is pretty broad. I believe it's whether it's admissible, the cocaine evidence admissible under the rules of evidence.
So you're saying that it's included in?
Yes.
Did we reframe the issue in this case,
yes.
I think.
Yes, we did.
Much more broadly than we've reframed it, and the court framed it as, is the evidence admissible under the rules of evidence? So I took that to mean.
So your position is that that includes the 403 issue, which is a separate independent grounds of the Court of Appeals opinion?
Yes, absolutely. Your Honor, my name is David Yoon, and I represent Dr. Weintraub. I agree with everything that Stevenson said. In addition, I'm going to address Rule 403, and if I have time, Rule 703. Plaintiff argues that the Court of Appeals correctly found that all references to cocaine should have been excluded as unfairly prejudicial under Rule 403. This includes not only Ms. Hurd's statement to Dr. Kelly, but Ms. Hurd's eyewitness testimony about plaintiff's cocaine consumption in the late 1990s, the circumstantial evidence of recent cocaine use, and expert testimony concerning cocaine. We submit the majority of the Court of Appeals erred and should be reversed because it gave no deference to the trial court's findings under Rule 403. It inverted the standard of review by maximizing the prejudicial effect of the cocaine evidence and minimizing the probative value. And it ignored circumstantial evidence of recent cocaine use and made findings of fact. And its ruling guarantees that the retrial will be one-sided and unfair. And let me address each of these points. First, the majority didn't give any deference to the trial court's findings. As this court knows, CRE 403 strongly favors admission of material evidence and gives a great deal of discretion to the trial court. Unless the trial court's ruling is manifestly arbitrary, capricious, or unfair, it shouldn't be disturbed. In this case, the trial court found that the cocaine use was the key to the case and was intensely probative because it explained, it provided the probable explanation for plaintiff's outcome, why he could not be resuscitated and why his heart stopped. This evidence was crucial to the issue of causation and rebutted plaintiff's anaphylaxis theory. Although the trial court found that the cocaine evidence was prejudicial, it determined that, quote, on balance, I think it is appropriate to permit that information in. And the court also noted that the issues that plaintiff raised, the concerns that the plaintiff raised, are suitable for cross-examination and also for ultimate argument. Despite these findings, the Court of Appeals, based on a cold record, simply disagreed with those findings, and we submit that's error. Second, in reviewing the trial court's ruling under Rule 403, this court stated that appellate court is required to assign the maximum probative value and the minimum unfair prejudice to the evidence. In a close case, this court said, the balance should be struck in favor of admitting the evidence. Here, the majority actually inverted the standard of review. It assigned a minimum probative value and maximum prejudicial effect. And the record supports the trial court's conclusion that the cocaine evidence was intensely probative.
Well, let's take your view of the case, sir. How close would the cocaine use have to be a cause of what occurred?
Well, we presented expert testimony that cocaine provided the only medical explanation for why a healthy man with no risk factors in his 40s suddenly had cardiac arrest and could not be resuscitated. So we have expert testimony to that effect by Dr. Kulit, our toxicologist.
But no evidence that he had cocaine in his system at the time.
Then we have, Your Honor, let me just go back.
Yeah, sure.
We have undisputed eyewitness testimony back in 1990s, late 1990s, that Ms. Herr observed plaintiff not only using cocaine, but the highly addictive crack, smoking highly addictive crack cocaine. And we have expert testimony saying that this is extremely addictive, more addictive than recreational cocaine, and that people who use this type of drug usually hide their consumption from others. Then we have circumstantial evidence. So we have medical testimony, then we have past, undisputed past testimony, and then we have circumstantial evidence of recent cocaine use. And that, and because of that, because the expert testimony was that cocaine use caused the outcome, I think it was probative, and certainly it was probative if the appellate court is required to assign the maximum probative value to the evidence.
Mr. Young, may I just ask you one question that I didn't understand? So you had your expert testify to this. That information, I take it, got in under Rule 703?
Yes.
Okay, and but then in addition, you had the girlfriend or the woman,
yes,
testify. That information got in under the hearsay exception.
Yes.
Or alternatively,
impeacher,
as a basis for the expert.
But she did testify.
She testified.
She testified.
Yes.
As opposed to just told the expert. She testified.
She testified,
and
not
then the
only
expert
to the conversation that she had with Dr. Kelly, but also her eyewitness testimony,
sure,
about past use. And I want to put it in the frame. She not only said that I witnessed it, I confronted him, went to the parents, then I caught him smoking crack. I confronted him, told him I'm going to go to the police, and I caught him using cocaine. And she also said that although I only saw it twice, there were other occasions that I thought he was using cocaine, and that I could tell when he was high. And as Your Honor might recall, she described that he would use it at night before she came in back to her home, and that when she thought he was using it, they would have fight, and he was not welcome.
Sure, I'm just trying to figure this out because I don't understand why. Let me ask you this. Judge Hobbs didn't make any findings with respect to 703, right?
Judge Hobbs made findings under 403. I think that Judge Hobbs was grouping
in the 800 series, but not the 700 series, right?
No, not under 703. And
was there an objection to this information coming in through the expert? He can or she can rely on this information, irrespective, usually, of its admissibility.
I believe there was a motion in limine, and I have to be clear. I think there was a motion in limine that the expert testimony was not, should be excluded.
Well, let me come at it a different way. If we were to determine that the Court of Appeals was correct in holding that this woman could not testify under the 800 series for purposes of treatment or diagnosis.
Yes.
Would it necessarily therefore mean that it was also an error to allow this information in under the 700 series, the expert?
It would be admissible under 703, as I stated. And that only goes to Ms. Hurd's statement to Dr. Kelly as a basis, but all eyewitness testimony, that comes in regardless.
Sure. So, and I'm sorry, I still have a place I want to go, so let me just keep interrupting you if I may one more time. So therefore, doesn't this kind of boil down to a 403 problem? Because if it's a 403 problem, the expert probably could not testify to it on the 700 series anyway. You can't come in and say, as an expert, well, I heard that, this guy was doing meth all the time, even though there was no factual basis for that. That would be more prejudicial than probative, And even if it did come under the 700 series, it couldn't come in, right?
Well, the court has to, the trial court has sure. to do a balancing test.
Sure,
for the
so we really were down to 403. Maybe you don't agree with that balance.
Well, I could understand the court's argument. I understand your thought process.
Sure.
But under 403, when I think it's admissible because the trial judge made the findings, did the evaluation, and this court has always said we give deference to that. And they did not. And that's what my main point is, that there was absolutely no deference to the trial court's findings. And you were supposed to assign maximum probative value to the evidence. And as I indicated, there's expert testimony that this cocaine explained the outcome. We have eyewitness testimony in the 90s, and then we have circumstantial evidence, which this court said you don't distinguish between circumstantial, the fact of circumstantial and direct evidence, and you let the jury decide whether or not it affected the outcome. And that's not, so the circumstantial evidence the court wants to know is our expert described 6 days prior to the hospitalization, he had what our expert described as cocaine psychosis. He's awake, he's sitting on the couch, he says, I see a white cloud coming at me, I see your dead roommate coming at me. And Ms. Hurst's statement was, what are you on, drugs? One. Two, he comes into the emergency room, he's pacing. And he's pacing, and he also has hepatitis C with no history of blood transfusion. He has filed bankruptcy in the past. He has abnormal heart. And our expert said it's not determinative of cocaine use, but it's certainly suggestive of cocaine use. And that circumstantial evidence, I would submit, the jury was responsible for determining what inferences to draw from that, not the court of appeals.
Mr. Young, can we just nail down a couple of little things? As I understand it, maybe this is wrong. Ms. Hurd denied a trial the statement that she gave to Dr. Keller, right?
Yes.
All right, so did that come in through impeachment? Ms. Hurd?
Yes.
There was a foundation laid, and then Dr. Kelly testified.
Yes, prior consistent statement. And that
was, what was the ruling of the court on that point?
That was not a basis for the court of appeals or the trial court's decision. I think the plaintiff never objected, but as an appellee, we can ask for the court to affirm the judgment on any grounds supported by the record.
And then there was also, I don't quite understand, is this, there was information given to, I guess, the guardian, that was hearsay about his cocaine use?
I believe there was an objection when he started recounting what others told him. And he testified was that I confronted my brother to stop, and he didn't think his brother stopped. That testimony kind of came in.
He didn't? I'm sorry. And that's not part of the issue either?
Well,
that's part of the cocaine use?
That was a piece of it, just a small piece of the evidence. I would say it's a minor piece, but he didn't testify regarding what others told him. He testified that he confronted his brother. That's the part that we relied on. And just going to last one point that I want to make, Ms. Hurd actually said that she testified regarding this conversation. She asked Dr. Kelly, could cocaine have been in his system? Could it have interacted with anesthesia, and could it have set him in cardiac arrest? That was during her direct testimony. That statement itself suggests that the cocaine use was reason. Why would Ms. Hurd be concerned about whether cocaine was in his system if it wasn't reason use? In any event, we submit that the dispute between Dr. Kelly and her, that was for the jury to resolve. I'd like to reserve the rest of the time. Yeah,
1:45.
You may. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Teresa Locke, and I represent the plaintiff below, Vasilios Harlampopoulos, through his brother and guardian, John Harlampopoulos. And I'm here today to talk to you about the erroneous admission of hearsay statements that did change the entire course of this case. Trial court admitted them under two exceptions to the hearsay rule, 803.4 and 807. And the Court of Appeals reversed and said that they should not have been admitted under either rule. The Court of Appeals was correct because underpinning all of the hearsay rules is the theories of or the concepts of trustworthiness and reliability. In order to fit within any of the exceptions to the 800 series, the statements need to be reliable, it needs to be trustworthy, and here it was neither. The defendants do make this argument that they need this inadmissible hearsay because it's the cornerstone or centerpiece of their case. And that's true. Without this inadmissible hearsay, they didn't have a case. They were, because the inadmissible hearsay was admitted, they were allowed to support a theory that was not based on any medically relevant information. But the fact that the defendants need this for their experts to rely on, because it supports the expert's theory, is not the determinative factor here. This court should maintain the integrity of the rules of evidence and should reaffirm that only hearsay statements with indicia of reliability are admissible and can be relied on by experts. The fact that Dr. Kulig, in this case, relied on these inadmissible statements, statements that the declarant herself denied making, statement that the listener of the statement, Dr. Kelly, did nothing with and didn't rely on in any way, the fact that the expert relied on that does not make the statement reliable. And even under 703, the court has to find that the statement is reliable before the expert can rely on it.
Help me out on this. You're saying it can't be used for impeachment purposes based on an inconsistent statement. She appeared at trial. She's testified.
She appeared in trial, but there are three reasons why it can't be used for impeachment purposes in this case. One, there was already a ruling by Judge Hobbs that said this evidence was coming in. So plaintiffs then proactively called Ms. Hurd as a witness and raised the issue. Plaintiffs would not have done that if Judge Hobbs had not made already a rule on our motion, repeated motions in limine, trying to exclude this evidence. So that's the first reason. We wouldn't have called her. Second, even under the prior inconsistent statement, there still has to be a basis for knowledge of the person making the statement. Statements don't come in under a prior inconsistent statement if somebody is saying, putting a fact out there, but then they don't have any basis to know that fact. That would allow people, the prior inconsistent statement rule, to bring in evidence that couldn't come in otherwise. In this instance, there's no evidence in the record of what her knowledge was. Defendants say that Mr. Harlampopoulos had lived with her for 6 months or stayed with her for 6 months prior to this. The important fact in this case, though, is that for 6 days prior to this procedure, he was not staying with her. She had not seen him for 6 days. She had talked to him briefly on the phone a few times, but she was not in his presence. And for her to say that, for Dr. Kelly to say that Ms. Hurd represented that he had been using in between November 21st and November 23rd, the two emergency room visits, would require her to have knowledge that he had done that. She wasn't with him, and there was no evidence in the record. Dr. Kelly did not ask her when she made the statement, how do you know this? Did you see him? Did you just hear it? If she heard it from somebody else, that's hearsay. So we don't have a record, and nor can a record be made because Dr. Kelly has already given his testimony on everything he could remember about that conversation.
And the woman disappeared for a while, but then when she came back, can you help fill those holes in for me, please, what happened there?
We could not, as plaintiffs, could not locate her for quite a while. Unbeknownst to us, defendants had an investigator that had located her and spoken with her on multiple occasions. But when Judge Hobbs made her initial ruling that she would then not reverse, Ms. Hurd had not been found by us, and defendants did not mention that they had talked to her. After the mistrial, and we were getting ready to set for another trial, we actually, our private investigator, did locate her. And she submitted an affidavit, which I attached in the appendix to our briefing, where she said, I didn't say that to Dr. Kelly. And she said, I wasn't Mr. Harlampopoulos' girlfriend. She defeated or refuted the whole basis for what the ruling was with respect to that information. So hopefully that fills in the gap.
Well, it does. And then it was brought, the information was brought back to Judge Hobbs.
It was, and Judge Hobbs said she wasn't persuaded by that. Judge Hobbs had determined that this was the key to the case and that defendants needed this for their theory, and therefore it was coming in. And then after Judge Hobbs rotated out of the courtroom and we had a new judge, Judge Egelhoff, we presented the issue again, and he was unwilling to back away from what Judge Hobbs had already ruled, and same with Judge Martinez when we actually tried the case. So the decision had already been made before Ms. Heard had even been heard from. The decision was made, and there was no going back on it at that point in time. So I want to talk about the 8034 test, and defendants have challenged the use of People v. Ali by this court and said that that case came after King and therefore it should not be relied on. But actually the test in King and the test in Ali are virtually the same. Both King, this court in King and in Ali, the court said that the statement has to be made for the purpose of diagnosis and treatment, and it has to be the kind of information that would be reasonably relied on by the physician. In People v. Martinez, again a Colorado Court of Appeal case in 2000, the court said that we have to look at all the circumstances to determine the motivation and the purpose of the statement. And in this instance, because the statement was not made by the patient himself, it's one step removed, it was made by Ms. Heard, we need to determine what her motivation was, and we need to determine if she had knowledge to actually make the statements that she made. When the court is going to allow somebody to be a surrogate spokesperson for the patient, who, by the way, can no longer talk for himself, so by the time this statement was made, he was incompetent and had no way to defend against anything that was being said. When the court is going to allow that kind of statement, there needs to be a special relationship. And it's not just a label of boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, those kind of things. It's an actual relationship. Does that person have the knowledge to be able to say this? And in this instance, this person, there's no basis to say that she has that knowledge. She was not his girlfriend at the time. She said that. She didn't go to the emergency room with him. She was not listed as the contact person on the emergency room intake paperwork. She said that she spoke to him briefly a couple of times on the telephone. She recounted those conversations, and none of them had anything to do with cocaine. The classic example, obviously, of the 8034 use is a mother bringing her child to the emergency room, or even an eyewitness saying, "I saw this auto accident, here's what happened," etc., so that there's direct knowledge. We don't have that in this case. Regarding motive, and this is detailed in our brief, but there are some circumstances which the court must consider from Martinez that point away from the fact that Ms. Heard had a motive to get a diagnosis or help with the diagnosis in the case. I think the most important one, I won't recount them all, but the most important one is that Dr. Kelly, according to his testimony, said that when Ms. Heard made this alleged statement to him, he said, "I'm not a cardiologist, I don't know." He did nothing further with it, didn't pass it along. Ms. Heard didn't do anything with it. She had just met earlier in the day with the cardiologist. She knew who the cardiologist was on the case. She had conversations with him. She did nothing further to go try to give that information to somebody that had the ability to do something with it. So that demonstrates in and of itself her motive. If she was really motivated to try to find a diagnosis, when Dr. Kelly said, "I'm not a cardiologist, I don't know," she would have gone to somebody else and asked the question.
Counsel, can I just stop you there then? Yeah, it's sorry. So what was her motive? I understand you want to go through what it wasn't.
Right.
To prove your legal point.
Sure.
But just what was her motive? Why would you say that
I think what I understand from Ms. Hurd's testimony, her motive that the family did not feel like they were getting sufficient information about what had happened here. They had had this family meeting, which, by the way, at the family meeting, there was no mention of hydatidsis at all, despite the fact that it was in the records and testing was being done for it. So the family was feeling like they were left in the dark.
She had been involved in that meeting and was proactively trying to get a doctor to tell them what had happened. So,
but isn't that exactly what a diagnosis, I mean, according to opposing counsel, isn't that seeking a diagnosis of sorts to deconstruct what happened for us?
I think it goes to Justice Rice's point about what the term diagnosis means in a medical sense.
So what's the distinction then in your mind?
The distinction in my mind is that Ms. Heard was, she was not responding to any kind of question that had been asked of her. She was inserting herself into a situation. And while she may have been trying to find out what circumstances happened in this procedure, that's why she went to Dr. Kelly. What circumstances happened in this procedure? What went wrong? But that's not to diagnose it and say that this caused it. She was going to say, you know, just sort of throwing anything out there that she could try to think of to try to get him to answer.
Why wouldn't her question be reliable?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Why wouldn't her question be reliable and trustworthy?
I think we have to look at all the circumstances surrounding it again, and her question itself could be reliable, but that's not what the hearsay is. The hearsay is what Dr. Kelly said. She said later in the conversation. So
well,
that initial
also
question.
The other, her other statements, which were her eyewitness statements by him.
Her eyewitness statements were from the 90s, and counsel has said that they were from the late 90s. The relationship was from 97 to 98. That was 7 years prior, at least 7 years prior to when this occurred. Dr. Clifford, defendant's own expert, said this could only be relevant. Information related to cocaine use could only be relevant if it was in the 2 years prior to the procedure. So anything that happened in the 90s is not relevant. That's true also with respect to what John Harlampopoulos said. The other issue while I'm on John Harlampopoulos, and then I want to say more about the 1990s, but John Harlampopoulos' statement was admitted because he was the guardian. And Judge Hobbs said he's a party opponent and it can be used for all purposes, despite the fact that he was just named as the guardian. And as a result, and defendants also said in the brief that we did not object to that. We did. We filed motions in limine about that. It was in our trial brief. Both times defendants moved to strike the motion in limine and the reference in the trial brief because it had already been decided by the court. But the point is that John Harlampopoulos said that what came into evidence was John Harlampopoulos saying, I didn't know if he'd been using, but I went to him and I said, if you have been using, please stop. And then defense counsel asked him, but he didn't stop completely, did he? And John said, no. And then John went on to testify, but he was certain that he hadn't been using after 2000.
But what about this manifestation when he came in for the procedure of the white cloud and the pacing and other things that would indicate that he presently had drugs in his system?
Well, all of those things were testified to by Dr. Kulig, who was the toxicologist in this case. And Dr. Kulig, as a toxicologist, you know, there's a saying that if to a hammer everything looks like a nail, to a toxicologist everything is looked at through lenses of drug abuse. And so the things that Dr. Kulig testified to, first of all, they wouldn't have come in had it not been for Ms. Heard's statement or alleged statement being admitted. We didn't file a Shrek motion. The court didn't deal with 703 because the court had already said all the statements come in, so there was no point at that point of trying to be able to file a 703 or Shrek motion. But without Ms. Heard's statement, then all of these other things, this cascade of symptoms that Dr. Kulig said would not be reliable and would not be things that should come in. Dr. Kulig, some of the examples of things that Dr. Kulig used, he said that because Mr. Harlampopoulos didn't look like he was on cocaine when he came to the emergency room, meant that he was, but he was skilled at hiding it. The fact that he had financial problems in the 1990s meant that he was a drug addict. The fact that he tested positive for hepatitis C antibody means he was a drug user. And counsel just said a minute ago that there was not no history of a blood transfusion. That's a little misleading because the blood transfusion that would have been an issue that he could have gotten hepatitis C from was prior to 1992. And there were no medical records prior to 1992. So no one knew, and of course Mr. Harlampopoulos is incapacitated, can't speak, and therefore he couldn't tell anybody if he'd had a direct blood transfusion.
Counsel, can I get you to focus though? Yes. Was there on the white cloud and
sure.
Was there an alternative explanation for that?
Absolutely.
Okay, can you help me with that?
Yes, and even Dr. Cooley admitted there was an alternative explanation. This occurred in the middle of the night. Mr. Harlan Popolis had a bad dream, and what had happened in that house prior was the reason that Mr. Harlan Popolis was staying with Ms. Heard for a period of time was that her roommate had died in the house and she was scared. And so she asked him to stay and sleep on the couch for a while. She would pay him to do that so that she didn't have to be there alone. When he awakes from this bad nightmare or this dream, he says this to her, and she testified that she believed him, that's why she had him stay there in the first place, because she was afraid. So there are other explanations to this white loud dream. People have bad dreams all the time. But again, to a toxicologist, that means he's a cocaine addict. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm reading from your opponent's brief. This doctor says, even if, this is the expert, I don't know which expert it is, even if plaintiff had been using cocaine very recently, if he was a chronic user and had cardiac arrhythmia caused by that, that's a possible explanation of difficulty in resuscitation. So is that consistent with the two-year business?
It is, because there's a predicate there, and that is, had he been using and there was a cardiac arrhythmia, that could have caused it. But the same expert testified that there was no cardiac arrhythmia here, and that any arrhythmia that occurred after the prolonged resuscitation. Everything that Dr. Flynn Zalita, who was the treating cardiologist, and Dr. Friedman, who was the plaintiff's cardiologist, the only two cardiologists in the case, looked at the testing and said there's nothing about this testing after the procedure that would indicate that it was anything more than a prolonged resuscitation. When you haven't been breathing for 38 minutes, you have issues with your heart. Dr. Clifford, who testified as the defendant's expert, also said that there was an EKG done on Mr. Von Poplos back in 1997 as a result of an accident that he had. When the EKG was done, it was red, and there was nothing in 1997 on the EKG that would have revealed cocaine abuse. While there were some abnormalities on it, they were not consistent with cocaine abuse. So we have some direct evidence from that very same time period. They are saying that he was a chronic cocaine abuser that demonstrate that there was nothing in his heart or about the functioning of his heart that would support him being a cocaine addict.
I guess this gets me back to the point that I've been kind of worrying with, which is trying to separate out whether there was sufficient evidence for the expert to testify under 703 about this theory of cocaine use, and just how much of that admission of that 703 evidence is really dependent upon the girlfriend, for lack of a better word's hearsay statement. And it seems like there was lots and lots of evidence over and above the girlfriend's hearsay statement, which would have been admissible in any event, to allow the defendants to put on this theory of cocaine usage.
Not medical evidence, Your Honor. There was evidence, this ghost, that he filed for bankruptcy.
That he used it in the past, that kind of thing.
That he had used it in the
crack, as opposed to just powder cocaine, all of that information. So if we're focusing the case down, is the fight really, is it boiling down to the information that he was using it in the 3 or 4 or 5 days before this incident?
It does.
So if we're boiling it down to that, the girlfriend did not tell Dr. Kelly that he was doing that, right?
Correct. That's what she testified to.
Even, although she says she now says nothing, she did not say that.
She did not say that.
Did Dr. Kelly testify as part of his expert opinion that she did say that, number one, that she did say that he was using it within the 5 or 6 days before this incident, and that he, not Dr. Kelly, but the expert, and that he's relying upon that?
Yes.
5 or 6 day period?
Yes, he is. And he also goes even further than that. Dr. Kulig said that Dr. Kelly said that his
Just call him by rules if you don't
know. Okay. The expert said that the defendant doctor said that Ms. Heard said
the girlfriend,
that they had used up their stash. They, meaning together, had used up their stash of cocaine in the few hours in between the emergency room visits, and that they'd used a significant amount. That is nowhere in Dr. Kelly's testimony or in his deposition. He didn't testify to it at trial.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. Who said that?
Dr. Kulig said that at
trial.
He's
the expert. And what's he basing that?
He said that that's what Dr. Kelly said in his deposition. Dr. Kelly didn't say that in his deposition. I don't know if Dr. Kelly told him that separately and it wasn't in the testimony or not, but he based his opinion in part on that. He also said at trial that he suspected that Mr. Harlampopoulos was actually using in the hospital, and he had absolutely no basis for that.
Okay, now wait, so the expert said that.
Correct.
His basis for that was defendant doctor's conversation.
Correct.
With girlfriend?
Defendant doctor's recitation of the conversation to Dr. Kulig, to the expert.
If it took place.
If it took
place. But your position is that the defendant doctor, even he did not say that.
Correct. Not in his deposition. I don't know what conversations he might have had with the expert.
Was the expert impeached on that information?
Yes, he was. He was, but at that point.
Well, does the defendant doctor testify?
The defendant doctor did testify.
Was he asked those questions and impeached about that?
I don't believe. I believe he testified before the defendant or the expert witness, and he was not recalled. No. But the point, I guess, that I'm trying to make is that the expert relied on this hearsay statement.
What you're saying is it's basically not harmless, that this is kind of the key to the case, that this
correct
cocaine usage was taking place a day or two or 3 days before this incident.
Absolutely.
Maybe even between the emergency room visits, and maybe even when he was in the hospital.
Correct.
And that was very damning testimony.
And there's absolutely no basis for that, is what you're saying. No factual basis.
There's absolutely no factual basis. And in fact, just the opposite. If you look at the vital statistic records, there's nothing about the defendant or the plaintiff, Mr. Harlampopoulos' vital statistics in the emergency room. And we're in the emergency room where these doctors and professionals are trained to look for drug addiction and intoxication because
was the term stash of cocaine actually used by this expert?
That was used by Dr. Kulig, the expert, yes. Yes. With respect to the one other point that I want to make with respect to that sort of chain of Dr. Kelly, the defendant doctor, telling the defendant's expert about this conversation that occurred 4 or 5 years previously. When you have, there's nothing about the rule that says that that can't happen, that one, that there can't be a chain of the conversation. But when there is a chain like that, you have to look at the reliability of the entire chain, not just the first instance where Ms. Hurd allegedly said this. And when you look at the chain, it breaks down with Dr. Kelly. As I just stated, the expert relied on things that were not in the record. And Dr. Kelly himself testified, the first time that this was brought up by Dr. Kelly, the defendant, was in his answers to discovery about 2.5 years after it occurred. It's not in the medical records. It wasn't shared with anybody. It wasn't written anywhere. The very first time it came up was in his discovery responses. Then he was deposed. And in his deposition, his memory of the conversation was about 3 years earlier, and he used words like, I think, I believe, I remember generalities. He couldn't remember how far after the procedure this conversation occurred. He didn't know if Mr. Harlampopoulos was on pain medication when he left the emergency room, which was sort of the whole basis for this. He didn't know whether or not the parties were living together at that time. So his memory at that time was vague at best.
Okay, the way you've portrayed your side of the case here is that trial judge hears that the defense has this theory. It's a theory of the case from their standpoint. It's key. She then hears that in the 90s he was a cocaine user. End of story.
Correct.
What should she have done to carefully sift through the 403 issue? Because that's done now.
She
put that in front of a jury.
Right. She should have looked at what the experts said is relevant. The experts said that the only cocaine use that's relevant is within the prior 2 years. Defendant's own expert said that. So anything from the 90s is not relevant unless The only way that the stuff from the 90s was relevant is if there was medical evidence that would have supported that he, in fact, had damage to his heart. Because it wouldn't have been in the system at that point in time. Well, we know that. Ms. Hurd didn't know that, but in any event, that's what the court should have done, said, okay, let's look at what Dr. Clifford, their expert, says. Let's look at, because Dr. Kulig, let me just point out that Dr. Kulig, who was the toxicologist expert, he didn't even come into this case until after Judge Havas had made the ruling. He was designated as a rebuttal expert in the case. And so he took that and then was able to rely on it. But if the court would have looked at what the experts, the defendant experts, said about what was relevant, then the stuff in the 90s wouldn't have come in at all. And then we're just looking at balancing, okay, these statements about a white puffy cloud, the statements about the pacing in the emergency room for somebody who's in pain, those types of things. And we would have filed a Shrek motion and the court would have ruled on it at that point in time.
Did you object to the statements that you just discussed that Dr. Kulig made about his conversations with Dr. Kelly about the stash and maybe it was used in when he was in the hospital and stuff like that?
We didn't object. Those actually came out on cross-examination, so they were used for impeachment. He didn't testify to that in his direct. He testified it on impeachment. On cross-examination.
By your side?
Correct. He'd already testified to it in his deposition. So then he was...
Did you file a motion in limine with respect to that? To the 703 information, yes.
To the 703...
This is what, as I understood it, what you're saying, this is 703, basically hearsay, which we would say is inadmissible as on the merits, but the doctor, an expert can do that. And this business about the stash and all that.
No, we did not file a motion to exclude those statements. I think at that stage, because Dr. Kulig was going to be testifying very broadly about his reliance on Ms. Hurd's statement and all of these other issues, I think the point was to try to show inconsistencies in that he was testifying to things that were outside the scope of the record to try to impeach him or to attack his credibility. With respect to Rule 703, I want to come back to that for just one moment because I think that the court still has to determine what is reliable in order, even under 703, yes, we understand that hearsay statements and inadmissible statements can be used by an expert to form their opinion, but the opinion still has to be something that's based on reliable information. And if the statement that was allegedly made by Ms. Hurd is not reliable, or Dr. Kelly's recitation of the statement is not reliable, then it's still not something that Dr. Kulig should have been allowed to rely on.
Ms. Locke, doesn't that go to the weight, though? I mean, really, when the statement comes in about the reliability, isn't that ultimately for the jury to decide? I understand that the court's going to be the gatekeeper on that, but the judge had determined that statement was made and admitted it. So isn't that... therefore go to the weight?
Well, at that stage it does, because she'd already admitted it into evidence, but I'm saying if it wasn't admissible otherwise, then she has to be a gatekeeper to determine whether or not it was reliable enough for Dr. Kulig to rely on.
Well, isn't there a difference between her statement, though, and then is he saying that she said that they were using cocaine at the hospital?
That's what Dr. Kelly said. That's what the expert said that Dr. Kelly said that.
Which Dr. Kelly didn't say.
Which doctor?
It seems to me that I was just kind of deconstructing this trial that maybe there just wasn't a sufficient winnowing of the issue because of a failure to kind of reconsider as more information came to light by the judge and by counsel as to exactly who was saying what. A Shrek motion or a motion in limine or any way that you get in front of the court kind of would have been helpful there. But what you're saying basically is, once Judge Havas made the decision, whatever this woman said is admissible, any spin that subsequently was given to that statement was equally admissible, but now under 703.
Correct. That is what I'm saying, Your Honor. I see my time is almost out. Just to sort of summarize or conclude, what one thing I want to leave the court with is, in this instance, it was the defendants trying to use a statement in a medical malpractice case. This could have easily been a plaintiff saying, a plaintiff's friend could have come in 2 years after the fact, 3 years after the fact, told the plaintiff's expert that, I told the doctor prior to the procedure, I'm a friend, I have a special relationship, I told the doctor prior to the procedure that my friend has had an adverse reaction to anesthesia. It's not reported, it's not relied on except by the expert. It comes in for all purposes, and that's the type of floodgate that a ruling affirming the trial court would open. Thank you, Your Honors. I would ask that the court affirm the Court of Appeals opinion and remand this case without cocaine evidence. Thank you.
Please, the court. Your Honor, first thing I have to set the record straight is I greatly disagree with plaintiff's characterization of Dr. Kulik's testimony. She mentioned that he talked about using a stash, using it at the hospital. That was not his direct testimony. On cross-examination, plaintiffs, for example, brings up, could it have been, didn't you testify in your deposition that he could have possibly used it, had the drugs, cocaine, while he was in the hospital? And he said, I said in my deposition that was a possibility. And then he said, but you don't have any evidence of that. So that wasn't what the direct testimony. It was testimony that was made in deposition that plaintiff's counsel was recounting to show to minimize this.
Well, what about the use of the girlfriend's use of the word stash?
I believe that was also on cross-examination. That he on direct examination, Dr. Kulik never mentioned stash. It was Mr. Jones was trying to impeach him by referring to words like that he used it in his deposition. So, first of all, just greatly disagree with that opinion. And as Justice Wright said, there was a lot of evidence of cocaine use, circumstantial evidence. We have medical experts.
But may I just interrupt? Was there a lot of evidence of cocaine usage in the relevant time period? That is, I guess, 2 years before or at the very, or more even specifically, 6 days or so before?
There was.
Because of the bankruptcy is, that's not evidence. So what is evidence in that six-day period before?
Sure. Medical testimony was this. Dr. Kulik said, cocaine may have ill effects on the heart. Quote, many, many years after they have been using the drug, even after they stopped using the drug. He put no time frame. Dr. Clifford testified, the two-year time period. He also acknowledged that cocaine used over a period can damage the heart muscle permanently. Other experts did not give a time frame, but they said history of long-term or chronic cocaine use can cause this difficulty in resuscitation. So first of all, I have to disagree that it's only relevant to 5 or 6. We have expert testimony saying if you used it many, many years ago, it could still have the effect. But we have eyewitness testimony, we have medical testimony that says it explains the cause, then we have all the circumstantial evidence, which our experts said is consistent, not determinative, with recent cocaine use. And we don't have just Ms. Hurd's statement. I mean, it's not just Ms. Hurd's statement. We actually have eyewitness testimony, separate and apart, and circumstantial evidence. You know. For all those reasons, we ask that the Court of Appeals be reversed. And the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Before we adjourn on this case, if you want another minute and a half, you're welcome to take it. Ms. Locke.
I would just say that what was done on cross-examination with Dr. Cooley, the expert, was done because all of the other evidence had come in.
We don't really care why it was done. You know, we're not into determining motive of the lawyers.
Okay. I think I would just point the court back to the basis for the rules and the reliability and ask the court to evaluate whether or not this information was reliable and should have been used as an exception to the rule.
If you have 30 more seconds, what do you say to Mr. Young's argument about extending the period of relevance back beyond the two-year period you're talking about to anything in the past?
I think that you can find every doctor that will say, yes, prolonged cocaine use can damage the heart, and therefore the heart, it can cause problems later. But the problem here is that there was no medical evidence of damage to the heart that was consistent with prolonged cocaine use. And so to say in the abstract that, yes, a cocaine abuser who's addicted to it and has been using it for 7, 8, 10 years could have problems, that's true, but there's no evidence to support that theory in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all the parties for your arguments and the briefs. The case will be submitted on briefs.